Fragment of a Ghost Story by Percy Bysshe Shelley. A shovel of his ashes took from the hearth's obscurest nook, muttering mysteries as she went. Helen and Henry knew that Granny was as much afraid of ghosts as any, and so they followed hard. But Helen clung to her brother's arm, and her own spasm made her shake.
So, remember that ghost story competition that Lord Byron posed in Lake Geneva in 1816? The one that resulted in Mary Shelley writing Frankenstein, Lord Byron writing Augustus Darvel, and John Polidori writing The Vampire? Well, that's all Percy Shelley wrote. Just 8 lines of a never-finished poem. What the hell, Percy? This is Frankenstein's Afterlife. You'd think Percy would be more into a horror writing competition, since horror is where his writing career began. Percy wrote his first literary work, titled Zastrozzi, at age 17, while attending Eton College. The short novella is classic gothic fiction. The title character, Zastrozzi, seeks to torture and torment Verezzi, a Bavarian man living in Munich. Zastrozzi first abducts Verezzi, but after Verezzi escapes, Zastrozzi spreads a rumor that Verezzi's beloved, Julia, has died. Verezzi agrees to marry another woman, but after it is revealed that Julia is alive, he is so distressed at his betrayal that he kills himself. Zastrozzi is arrested for murder, and at his inquisition, he reveals that Verezzi was his half-brother. Zastrozzi says that he blamed their mutual father for his mother's death, and that he had killed their father, but also sought revenge against his progeny forever. Zastrozzi, an outspoken atheist, celebrates having condemned Verezzi's soul to eternal damnation by driving him to suicide. Zastrozzi dies on the rack, still condemning Christianity and morality. Percy followed this with another gothic novella, St. Irvine. That story begins with a lonely outcast named Wolfstein wandering the Swiss Alps. Wolfstein is abducted by a group of bandits, but soon escapes, along with Megalena, whom the bandits also kidnapped, and Ginotti, a member of the bandits whom Wolfstein has befriended. After a couple of misadventures, including several murders and attempted seductions, Ginotti reveals to Wolfstein that he is an alchemist seeking the secret to eternal life.
Natural philosophy, at last, became the peculiar science to which I directed my eager inquiries. Thence was I led into a train of labyrinthic meditations. I thought of death. I shuddered when I reflected, and shrank in horror from the idea, selfish and self-interested as I was, of entering a new existence to which I was a stranger. I must either dive into the recesses of futurity, or I must not. I cannot die. Will not this nature, will not the matter of which it is composed, exist to all eternity? Ah, I know it will. And by the exertions of the energies with which nature has gifted me, well, I know it shall. This was my opinion at that time. I then believed that there existed no God.
He promises to share this secret with Wolfstein if Wolfstein renounces his faith. In the final scene, which takes place at the Abbey of St. Irvine in France, Megalena is dead, and Ginotti again offers Wolfstein power over life and death. Wolfstein refuses, and both men are struck dead in a lightning storm. Wolfstein attains salvation, while Ginotti is condemned to hell. You can see how both of these novellas have been interpreted as heavy influences on Frankenstein. The sublime Western European settings, the obsession with conquering death, the central conflict between the protagonist and antagonist, who both serve as doubles for one another. But then again, these are all gothic motifs that predate Percy by several decades, and were common in the genre. After these early efforts, it didn't take long for Percy to discover that his sensibilities were better suited to verse than prose. His first major success in long-form poetry came in 1813 with Queen Mab. In that poem, the titular queen is a fairy who considers the oppression and injustices of the past and present, but shows visions of a utopian future.
All things are void of terror. Man has lost his terrible prerogative, and stands an equal amidst equals. Happiness and science dawn delayed upon the earth. Peace cheers the mind. Health renovates the frame. Disease and pleasure cease to mingle here. Reason and passion cease to combat there.
Percy's vision of utopia is grounded in science and reason, it rejects any kind of religion or superstitious belief. This is a theme that Percy returned to throughout his career, including in Hymn to Intellectual Beauty, a major poem that Percy actually did complete during that summer in Geneva. 1816 was the first time that Percy had been to Switzerland, and he was profoundly moved by the beauty of the Swiss Alps. To his friend, Leigh Hunt, he wrote that the poem was composed under the influence of feelings which agitated me even to tears. In the poem, Percy addresses intellectual beauty, by which he means the Platonic idea of beauty, as opposed to any specific beautiful thing. He repeatedly invokes the image of beauty casting a shadow over him. In one stanza, he reflects on his childhood interest in the supernatural, before that pursuit was eclipsed by beauty's shadow.
While yet a boy, I sought for ghosts, and sped through many a listening chamber, cave and ruin, and starlight wood, with fearful steps, pursuing hopes of high talk with the departed dead. I called on poisonous names with which our youth is fed. I was not heard. I saw them not. When musing deeply on the lot of life, at that sweet time when winds are wooing all vital things that wake to bring news of birds and blossoming, sudden thy shadow fell on me. I shrieked and clasped my hands in ecstasy.
I find this passage interesting for how it parallels the image in that fragment that Percy wrote for the competition, with the children, Henry and Helen, searching for ghosts. It might even offer an explanation for why Percy never finished the ghost story. Hymn to Intellectual Beauty represents Percy's turning away from the Gothic towards a more utopian vision of the sublime. Of course, that sounds all very nice and high-minded, but it's also a little condescending to the Gothic. On Christmas 1817, Percy found himself in another writing competition, and this one he actually managed to finish. Percy and Horace Smith challenged each other to write sonnets based on a passage from the Greek historian Diodorus Siculus, which described a massive Egyptian statue and quoted its inscription, "King of kings, Ozymandias am I. If any want to know how great I am and where I lie, let him outdo me in my work." Percy revises this quotation in his sonnet and follows it with an image of desolation.
"My name is Ozymandias, king of kings. Look on my works, ye mighty, and despair. Nothing beside remains. Round the decay of that colossal wreck, boundless and bare, the lone and level sands stretch far away."
The poem was published on January 11th, 1818, just 10 days after Frankenstein. I like to think that Mary's work on her novel bore an influence on Percy's sonnet with its bleak indictment of man's hubris. Just as Victor failed to immortalize himself in the form of his creature, Ozymandias failed to immortalize himself in the form of his empire. The hubris of kings, specifically, is Percy's ultimate target. This comes out most clearly in Percy's next major work, Prometheus Unbound. Prometheus Unbound is a closet drama, meaning it's presented as a play, but it was never intended to be performed on stage. Percy began work on it in the summer of 1818. It was very loosely inspired by the poet Aeschylus, whose Promethea consisted of three plays: Prometheus Bound, Prometheus Unbound, and Prometheus the Firebringer, of which only the first survived to Percy's time in its entirety. In this trilogy of plays written by Aeschylus, the god Jupiter has Prometheus, the creator of humankind, chained to a mountain for bringing fire to his creation. Based on what we know from surviving fragments, in the sequels, Heracles frees Prometheus, and Prometheus and Jupiter eventually reconcile. Percy's Prometheus Unbound features no such reconciliation. It begins with Prometheus chained to the rocks, but rather than yielding to Jupiter's tyranny, Prometheus forgives him. This act of forgiveness prompts the water nymph Panthea, who had been attending to Prometheus, to go to her sister, Asia. Asia is Prometheus's love, and together, she and her sister hatch a plan to overthrow Jupiter. This plan involves enlisting the help of the Demogorgon.
The Demogorgon!
We're deep shit!
That's right, folks. Long before he was a big bad on Stranger Things, before he was a character in Dungeons & Dragons, the Demogorgon was a stock demon who would make appearances in works like The Faerie Queen, Dr. Faustus, and Paradise Lost. Here, the Demogorgon wields the volcanic power of the underworld, and he vanquishes Jupiter in a massive volcanic eruption. By the play's end, Prometheus is freed and reunited with Asia, and in a closing monologue, the Demogorgon warns that humanity must be vigilant against tyranny, but calls on everyone
to love and bear, to hope, till hope creates from its own wreck the thing it contemplates.
I find this play fascinating. It explores themes that were central to all of Percy's major works since Queen Mab: the possibility of liberation from tyranny, a utopian vision of the future, and a critique of religious belief. But using Prometheus to embody these themes is particularly interesting, especially coming on the heels of his wife's novel, which was subtitled A Modern Prometheus. Prometheus is a distinctively romantic hero to writers of the time, a titan who defies the gods to liberate humanity by bringing them their first technology. As Percy puts it in his introduction to Prometheus Unbound,
"The only being resembling in any degree Prometheus is Satan. And Prometheus is, in my judgment, a more poetical character than Satan, because in addition to courage and majesty and firm and patient opposition to omnipotent force, he is susceptible of being described as exempt from the taints of ambition, envy, revenge, and a desire for personal aggrandizement, which, in the Hero of Paradise Lost, interfere with the interest. But Prometheus is, as it were, the type of the highest perfection of moral and intellectual nature, impelled by the purest and truest motives to the best and noblest ends."
We'll examine the Romantics' view of Satan and the parallels between Prometheus and Satan in a future episode. But for Percy, what's distinctive about Prometheus is his status as an intellectual. Prometheus is a creator, an inventor, a technologist, a scientist. Percy's veneration of science comes across most clearly in the play's second act, when Asia solicits the Demogorgon's assistance. Asia asks the Demogorgon to utter the name of God, to which the Demogorgon repeatedly replies simply, "He reigns." This prompts Asia to deliver a monologue in which she offers a history of the cosmos, of the creation of the Earth and of humans, so as to elevate Prometheus and challenge Jupiter's reign.
"Who reigns? There was the heaven and earth at first, and light and love, then Saturn, from whose throne time fell, an envious shadow. Such the state of the earth's primal spirits beneath his sway, as the calm joy of flowers and living leaves, before the wind or sun has withered them, and semi-vital worms. But he refused the birthright of their being, knowledge, power, the skill which wields the elements, the thought which pierces this dim universe like light, self-empire, and the majesty of love, for thirst of which they fainted. Then Prometheus gave wisdom, which is strength, to Jupiter, and with this law alone, let man be free, clothed him with the dominion of wide heaven. To know nor faith, nor love, nor law, to be omnipotent but friendless is to reign. And Jove now reigned, for on the race of men, first famine, and then toil, and then disease, strife, wounds, and ghastly death unseen before, fell. And the unseasonable seasons drove with alternating shafts of frost and fire their shelterless pale tribes to mountain caves. And in their desert hearts fierce wants he sent, and mad disquietudes, and shadows idle of unreal good, which levied mutual war, so ruining the lair wherein they raged. Prometheus saw, and waked the legioned hopes which sleep with enfolded Elysian flowers, Nepenthe, Molly, Amaranth, fadeless blooms, that they might hide with thin and rainbow wings the shape of death. And love he sent to bind the disunited tendrils of that vine which bears the wine of life, the human heart. And he tamed fire, which, like some beast of prey most terrible, but lovely, played beneath the frown of man, and tortured to his will iron and gold, the slaves and signs of power, and gems and poisons, in all subtlest forms, hidden beneath the mountains and the waves, he gave man speech, and speech created thought, which is the measure of the universe. And science struck the thrones of earth and heaven, which shook but fell not, and the harmonious mind poured itself forth in all prophetic song. And music lifted up the listening spirit until it walked, exempt from mortal care, godlike, or the clear billows of sweet sound. And human hands first mimicked and then mocked, with molded limbs more lovely than its own, the human form, till marble grew divine, and mothers, gazing, drank the love men see reflected in their race, behold and perish. He told the hidden power of herbs and springs, and disease drank and slept. Death grew like sleep. He taught the implicated orbits woven of the wide wandering stars, and how the sun changes his lair, and by what secret spell the pale moon is transformed when her broad eye gazes not on the interlunar sea. He taught to rule, as life directs the limbs, the tempest-winged chariots of the ocean, and the Celt knew the Indian. Cities then were built, and through their snow-like columns flowed the warm winds, and the azure ether shone, and the blue sea and shadowy hills were seen. Such the alleviations of his state Prometheus gave to man, for which he hangs withering in destined pain. But who rains down evil, the immedicable plague, which, while man looks on his creation like a god, and sees that it is glorious, drives him on, the wreck of his own will, the scorn of earth, the outcast, the abandoned, the alone. Not Jove, while yet his frown shook heaven aye, when his adversary from adamantine chains cursed him, he trembled like a slave. Declare, who is his master? Is he too a slave?
This is a beautiful, fiery passage, but frankly, next to Frankenstein, I think that it comes across as pretty simplistic. For Percy, Prometheus embodies science and reason, and science and reason represent liberation. Thanks to the science of Prometheus, we have cities, we have communication across cultures, we have cures for diseases. Progress is unambiguously good. There's no sense that anyone could be left out by this progress. No sense that while science liberates some, it might oppress others. It strikes the thrones of heaven and earth with no unintended consequences whatsoever. But the modern Prometheus, of course, shows us that there can be terrible unintended consequences, that scientific rationalism is not unto itself an unambiguous good, that science is dangerous and has to coexist with compassion and moral sense. That's a complication with which you never really see Percy Shelley wrestle. If he'd had a longer life, maybe he would have gotten around to wrestling with it. If he had made it to the age of 30, maybe his wife would have taught him a thing or two. But he died in a sailing accident on July 8, 1822, at the age of 29. Now, I've been hard on Percy here for his rather naive belief in the power of scientific rationalism. And I was hard on him last episode for his extramarital affairs. But to his credit, he was always honest about his free love ethos, to which Mary adhered as well, at least in theory. And his vision of a future freed from war and economic exploitation has inspired generations of radical political thinkers, from Mahatma Gandhi to leader of the UK's Labour Party, Jeremy Corbyn, who had this to say at the Glastonbury Festival this past summer.
I'd like to quote one of my favorite poets, Percy Bysshe Shelley. The line I like the best is this one. Rise like lions after slumber, in unvanquishable number. Shake your chains to earth like dew, which in sleep had fallen on you. Ye are many, they are few.
Mary Shelley lived almost 30 years after Percy's death, and remained a steward of her husband's legacy his entire life, editing and publishing several volumes of his poems and essays. In an introduction to Queen Mab, she wrote about her husband,
"He was animated to greater zeal by compassion for his fellow creatures. His sympathy was excited by the misery with which the world is bursting. He witnessed the sufferings of the poor, and was aware of the evils of ignorance. He desired to induce every rich man to despoil himself of superfluity, and to create a brotherhood of property and service, and was ready to be the first to lay down the advantages of his birth. He was of too uncompromising a disposition to join any party. He did not in his youth look forward to gradual improvement. Nay, in those days of intolerance, now almost forgotten, it seemed as easy to look forward to the sort of millennium of freedom and brotherhood, which he thought the proper state of mankind, as to the present reign of moderation and improvement. Ill health made him believe that his race would soon be run, that a year or two was all he had of life. He desired that these years should be useful and illustrious. He saw, in a fervent call on his fellow creatures to share alike the blessings of the creation, to love and serve each other, the noblest work that life and time permitted him."
This podcast was written, narrated, and produced by Brian Motzke at the University of Michigan. Curtis Motzke helped design our cover art. Additional voice work was provided by Steven Nelson. Steve has his own podcast, DIY Democracy, in which he tries to learn more about citizenship and improve civic engagement. You can check it out by searching for DIY Democracy on iTunes or the podcatcher of your choice. Asia was voiced by Rebecca Adams Wright. Rebecca is a writer in Ypsilanti, Michigan. If you enjoy science fiction, fantasy, and magical realism, and if you're listening to this podcast, then I imagine that you do, then you have got to check out her story collection, The Thing About Great White Sharks and Other Stories. It's a fantastic read. You can find her at radamswright.com. That's radamswright.com. And once again, Mary Shelley was voiced by Mary Shelley. We can be found on iTunes. Please rate, review, and share our podcast to help more people find the show. We also have a Facebook page where you can find updates about the show and links to all the sources on every episode. Just search for Frankenstein's Afterlife on Facebook or go to facebook.com/frankafter. So now we've looked at some of the biggest poets around 1820. On the next episode, we'll consider the biggest novelist of the time.